All right. So Iran faces a crisis now, the likes of which has not been seen since the 1979 revolution. And in recent months, it's also experienced the biggest and most significant wave of strikes in the oil, gas, and petrochemical sector that have happened since the 1979 revolution. So what I'm going to do in this introduction is to focus a bit more on the strikes and protests that have been happening in Iran. Firstly, because obviously, it's incredibly inspiring and hopeful and a side of struggle in a world in which we haven't seen quite as much of that mass struggle. It has been happening, but not so much in the past 12 months in the midst of the pandemic. In Iran, what is deepening and broadening and refusing to lay down is a pretty incredible, increasingly militant and radical resistance to one of the world's most sadistic authoritarian regimes that also happens to be a major power in the Middle East region. The other reason why I'm going to focus on the strikes and the protests is because there is a lot to talk about in relation to the overall context in Iran in which this growing radicalization is taking place. Not the time to cover all of that, though, but that means there's plenty of time for people to do that in the discussion. I guess, though, just to summarize the overall situation, which people would already have some awareness of, there is a very deep and very broad society-wide crisis in Iran right now that has been accelerating particularly intensely over the past 5 years, which has been evidenced by the fact that mass countrywide protests really started to explode and build from 2017 and then really hit a high point in very militant mass anti-regime protests in 2019, during which at least 3,000 protesters were killed by the regime and many more thousands were arrested and imprisoned. And the character of those mass countrywide protests that occurred in every province, the length and breadth of Iran, was that they were extremely political and anti-regime. The targets of the protesters were symbols of the institutions of the regime. So around 700 police stations were burnt down, hundreds of banks set on fire. And the main slogans of protesters were for the clerics, the religious leaders to leave, and Khomeini, the then president, to leave. They were not polite demands being made by protesters. They were very militant and enraged. So common slogans, common chants at protests were the people want the fall, but the people want the regime to fall, down with Khomeini, we don't want an Islamic Republic, and down with dictatorship. There have been protests of students and protests organised out of university campuses in solidarity with local anti-regime actions and increasingly in connection with solidarity with workers' strikes. And all of this is because the dimensions of the crisis are so broad and so deep. So there's a crushing economic crisis for the working class and poor who are absolutely on their knees, barely able to survive. 60% of the population of 84 million are living at or below the poverty line. And that poverty line in Iran is an extreme situation. So it means food inaccessible, fuel and energy are increasingly unaffordable, increased homelessness, non-payment of wages for months and months, skyrocketing unemployment, inflation, government subsidies removed from food and energy and basic staples. There's the crushing impact of the US sanctions, which have massively disproportionately impacted workers, and they are criminal and they should never have been imposed. They're a tool used by ruling classes as part of inter-imperialist competition. They should be removed immediately. There's the impact of Iran's various regional interventions in the region, spending billions of dollars in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, funding Hezbollah, and to a lesser extent in Yemen. There are hideous, very serious and worsening environmental problems that are hugely impacting and threatening people's lives and their ability to work in various regions of the country, particularly and criminally in the oil-rich south of the country, like in Khuzestan, where there have been enormous protests that happened alongside these strikes that I'm going to start to talk about soon that began in June across 15 different cities in Khuzestan. They're particularly criminal because Khuzestan is an oil-rich part of the country. It's the wealthiest region in the country. It borders Basra in Iraq. And there have been criminal water shortages there, dangerous sandstorms that send, you know, hundreds, sometimes thousands of people into emergency departments every year with respiratory problems. There's a 50-year record drought. And it's not all, this is not all down to climate change. It's down to the criminal mismanagement and neglect of the regime around the misuse of the country's water resources, energy resources, agricultural practices, and so on. Like, sandstorms are not uncommon in the Middle East, but these sandstorms are not the usual sorts of things. They're about soil degradation through criminal practices of water mismanagement and so on. And then, of course, there's the COVID crisis, which is the worst in the region, and there's now another shocking wave of that. It's impossible to get accurate statistics. Like, officially, it's for, you know, about 500 people a day dying. But when you look at pictures of mass graves being dug around the country in the last couple of weeks, I'm very confident in saying I would expect that figure to at least be 4, 5, 6, who knows, maybe more times the size of 500 a day. And now on top of all this, you know, there's a refugee crisis from Afghanistan. There have already been thousands of refugees fleeing into Iran. There could be more. There could be fallout from the takeover of the Taliban. We'll have to wait and see. That could also really destabilize regions in Iran that border Afghanistan. The response of the regime to this immense multidimensional crisis, where one dimension of the crisis intersects with and exacerbates every other dimension, has been repression, violence, obviously the mass shootings of 2019, and since then, ongoing mass arrests of protesters, prominent activists, women's rights activists, trade union and labor leaders. There's so many, there's so many activists that are being jailed, tortured, and so on. It would be impossible to name all of some of the very well-known activists. Further responses of the regime, cuts to living subsidies and wages and the withholding of wages, as I've mentioned. The regime, through its restructuring of labour relations in the neoliberal period, has designed a system of contracting in which the contracting companies are controlled by them, the regime. And so in the oil, gas and petrochemical sector, they still take all the revenues, the profits from both state-owned and privately owned plants, and they withhold wages for workers, over 80% of all Iraqis workers in Iran are contract workers. And what's clear with the recent election of Ibrahim Raisi, who is a hardliner cleric, ultra-conservative, mass murderer, who was the head of the judiciary in Iran that oversaw a concerted campaign of mass murder, torture and imprisonment of political activists in the 1980s, leftists, trade unionists, people who participated in the 79 revolution. Is it the regime, in response to this unprecedented crisis, unprecedented since 1979, is hardening up? There's no signs whatsoever even of concessions being promised to the Iranian working class, despite the fact that there is now an ever-widening and deepening crisis of legitimacy for the Iranian regime that was expressed in voter turnout to the election of Raisi in June. It was the lowest voter turnout since the 79 revolution. Around 48% of the voting public supposedly turned out, and it's widely reported that the election was totally rigged. And it's not that they couldn't offer concessions. There is enormous wealth in the regime, despite the sanctions. They just won't. And that is partly because of Iran's expansionist, imperialist interventions in the region as a major regional power in competition with Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey, and so on. And that has been one of the other major grievances of protesters in recent years, that the regime has been ploughing billions of dollars into its interventions, particularly in Syria, to prop up Bashar Assad, obviously into their proxy militia Hezbollah in Lebanon, but also increasingly into Iraq, where they gain growing influence, especially with the defeat of the United States in Iraq. So sections of the working class in Iran have responded to this overall crisis and also the election of Raisi by planning and implementing mass strikes to coincide with his election. The strikes in the oil and gas and petrochemical sector actually kicked off a day after his election. And most notably, it's been contract workers in the oil and gas and petrochemical sector right across the country. They make up 70% of workers in the oil, gas and petro sector. And once they started their strikes, they were joined by sections of other workers who've been at the forefront of strikes in recent years. So bus drivers in Tehran, oil tanker drivers, municipal workers who are sort of like council workers, nurses, teachers, and the now notorious Haft Tapa sugarcane workers from the Khuzestan province. And by all accounts, these strikes have not stopped. So it's very hard to get information out of Iran about the strikes. But a recent report that I read just from last week has said that the nationwide strike of Iranian oil workers, which started after the June 18 elections and spread to 114 oil, gas and petro companies, has now entered its third month. So that's a report from a couple of weeks ago, or just last week. People would remember that there was quite a broad nationwide strike wave last year, which does it's possible that that strike wave, which happened around June, July of last year, might have been a bit broader than this one. So last year, that strike wave actually drew in workers in all different parts of manufacturing, agricultural workers, steel workers, miners, concrete workers, transport workers, a lot of municipal workers, nurses, teachers and other healthcare workers, and the Huffstupper sugarcane workers. It was a nationwide strike wave. And the Tehran bus drivers, as well as workers from the oil, gas and petro sector. And that strike wave lasted for a month to 2 months. But whilst this one may not be quite as broad, although there are some claims that it is, where it definitely has been bigger and more concerted than it was last year has been in the oil, gas and petrochemical sector. So this time, tens of thousands of workers in over 100 plants in 15 provinces joined the strike, which has been very broadly planned and given some direction and a campaign name by an informal council called the Organising Council of Contract Oil Workers under the banner 1400 campaign, 1400 marks 2021 in the Persian calendar. And this council actually represents, I would argue, pretty obviously, a step forward even from last year in an attempt to more formally organise workers. It's not a trade union. Independent trade unions are banned in Iran. Although significant and now very leading trade unions that have been formed anyway, and some of them were organising underground until the last decade, like the Tehran Bus Workers Union and the Huffstupper Sugarcane Union, those unions have been organising some very impressive and militant strikes over the past decade, which has really been central to reviving the labour movement in Iran. So with this latest wave of strikes of oil workers, there's been some particular characteristics of the strikes that have marked them out. The main thing is that they are strikes of workers in the petrochemical sector who are integral to the sector, but they're not permanent workers. And they're not workers who work in the productive core of the oil and gas sectors, who, like the people who are actually extracting and producing oil and gas. Those workers are permanent workers. They're tenured workers who are obviously some of the most powerful workers in Iran, who literally have their hands on the levers of profit making. So these striking contract workers are other trades workers who work at the petrochemical plants. They are integral to the functioning of the plants. But because they're forced onto contracts with these corrupt regime-controlled contractors hiring and firing them at will, they are less secure workers. And the regime does just sack them and assumes that it has a plentiful supply of other desperate workers to fill their jobs. So the key to the success of these strikes, obviously, ultimately, will be drawing in these more permanent workers. Who actually are at the core of the profit-making core of the sector. And so far that hasn't quite eventuated. There were pledges made that some of them on the 30th of June would join the strikes, but that didn't happen. That's partly because the regime offered concessions and pay rises to those workers to stop them from going on strike. So on the one hand, these strikes have been bigger, they're better organised than last year, but there are some limitations that are going to have to be overcome. And some of the more leading and well-known unions, like the Huffstupper Sugarcane Workers Union, the Tehran bus drivers and the teachers, have inserted themselves and are increasingly inserting themselves a bit into the overall situation because they do carry authority. So they've been urging other workers across Iran to go on strike themselves in solidarity with the oil workers and calling for general strikes. And one of the really encouraging things about these unions and their demands and calls to workers across Iran, not just now, but in the past decade, have been that they incorporate increasingly more political demands into their statements, like for the regime to be overthrown. In the case of the Huffstupper sugarcane workers, very more and more upfront political statements, anti-capitalist statements, So demands for the regime to be overthrown, for workers to run production themselves, but also very strong demands for unity amongst oppressed ethnic groups and minorities and Persian Iranians, who are the majority, arguing that this is essential to overcome the divisions that the regime and the bosses have created amongst the working class. And these divisions have been very consciously constructed by the regime, particularly in provinces that are rich with oil and gas and that are also ethnically diverse, like Khuzestan, which is where the Haftapa sugarcane workers are based. The demands of the striking contract workers in the oil and gas and petro sector have been for the legal right to form independent unions, for decent accommodation to live in when they're working. People are now working in 50-degree heat out in the desert in the middle of summer. They are demanding permanency, permanent contracts, payment of their wages on time, back pay, collective bargaining, and these are very crucial demands to win, because currently many of these workers work in these zones in the country that the regime has created in the past decade called special economic zones, in which regular Iranian labour laws do not apply. They are specially designed export zones that are they're basically lawless in terms of rights for workers. And so they represent another division in the working class created by the regime. So on the one hand, there is this undeniable radicalising happening in the working class, and at the same time, genuine developments in terms of attempts to organise, create new unions, and even in some workplaces like the Haftapa sugarcane factory, attempts being made, or they have, this has happened in Haftapa, to set up workers' councils. And Haftapa, where there are about 6,000 workers, they have set one up and at various points have been running their factory themselves, with a lot of solidarity and coordinated organising happening in the province in which their factory is located. And it is actually the case in Iran now that not only are there some parallels in the situation that existed in Iran in 1979 that are repeating themselves, but there are some key legacies from the 79 revolution, like the legacy of the formation of masses of workers' councils called shouras in Iran, which were key to overthrowing the monarchy and the revolution then, that are starting to be formed, not on a mass basis. So there's some differences, but there's a general discussion taking place in the working class about this, and in some places workers' councils are being formed. There's also some very, very key differences between what is happening in Iran now and what happened in 79. That mean it's obviously not the exact same situation. Of course, things aren't just going to follow the same path, and revolutions don't ever just repeat themselves in the same way. But I wanted to reflect just a bit on the particular legacy of the Workers' Council, because there are various Iranian leftists, socialists, you know, in touch with radical workers' networks in Iran, who are reporting that there is a consciousness re-emerging around the formation of workers' councils that is being actively argued for, as I said, like workers at the Haftapa sugarcane factory. So I'll just give some information about the legacy of that and how that's sort of playing out now in Iran. So the former workers of Iran, as in the equivalent of those 30% of workers at the core of the oil, gas and petro sector in Iran now, who remained silent for most of 1978 as a revolutionary movement of strikes and protests were building, those workers ensured the downfall of the monarchy with widespread strikes through the final months of that year and into the beginning of 1979. In many, many factories, particularly in the oil industry where ownership had fled the country, secret strike committees were transformed into workers' councils that took control of production and distribution. And one of the things that allowed quite a bit of space for this strike wave to deepen and the councils to be expanded and operate was that the person who became the opposition leader at the head of the revolutionary uprising, Ali Khamenei, who really represented the middle classes and the clergy, talked left and openly backed the strikes, leveraging a kind of, Islamic type of left populism. And he leveraged the strike movement to overthrow the monarchy, and the left, Stalinists, Maoists and Castroites and their guerrilla outfits betrayed the working class. Because of their politics, they utterly betrayed the working class, who had formed workers' councils alongside neighbourhood councils, in many places controlled by leftists, which were a problem for the consolidation of the new regime, Khamenei's regime. But the workers, without a revolutionary left to argue for Soviet-type bodies to be constructed and for the working class to take power, were co-opted and suppressed within a couple of years. Thousands of militant workers were arrested. Hundreds were executed. Thousands of socialists and communists were executed. Many had to flee the country and many others were banished. And then ultimately, Islamic committees, Islamic associations closely tied to national secret services replaced neighborhood and workers' councils respectively, and independent trade unions were banned, and workers' councils that had played a crucial role in the victory of the revolution were crushed. But the experience of those years and of workers' councils as the apex of the revolutionary movement remained in workers' consciousness and became the subject of society-wide discussions in Iran. And that has never disappeared into the rear view of workers. They are still a pretty recent phenomenon, 40 years ago, to the extent that some of the leading activists in some of the unions that have formed and led the labor movement revival in Iran in recent years either participated in those workers' councils or they have parents and other family members who did. Workers' protests that were a key feature of the 1979 struggles in the formal manufacturing and services sector, strikes, gatherings, and sit-downs, actually started to re-emerge in the 2010s, developing into regional worker uprisings in some cases, despite the prohibition of independent working class institutions, including unions. Waves of protests actually began in the late 1990s. Some in the oil sector and some also through the formation of a painter's syndicate led by a leftist painter called Sharok Zamani. And some big strikes happened, as I said, in some of the oil fields. But unions were still illegal. And so even though collective bargaining is allowed under Iranian labor law, it's never put into practice because of the illegality of unions. Islamic councils or Islamic associations are the only legally existing workers' institutions, but they are directly controlled by the government. They obviously don't bargain on behalf of the workers. Consequently, over the past two decades, in the face of rising prices, decreasing or simply non-payment of wages, arbitrary arrests and privatisation, workers have been forming independent illegal syndicates, unions, to collectively bargain with their employers. For example, as I've said, Reza Shahabi and the Tehran bus drivers of the United Bus Company, they formed the Vahed Union, the Vahed Syndicate in 2005. Ali Najati and the workers of Haftapa Sugarcane, after a series of strikes and clashes with the police, formed their union in November 2007, officially. The government has not officially recognised any of these unions, has refused their demands, has imprisoned the representatives of the workers in order, obviously, to instill fear in workers everywhere. The government arrested and killed Sharok Zamani, the leftist painter who formed the Painters Union in February 2016. His murder didn't have, though, the desired effect. Workers continued their protests. Across the country, they went on strikes to demand past wages, wage increases, better working conditions, and the permission to form unions. Because most state-owned factories have become unprofitable over the past decades, they've been sold to government officials or to their relatives at a fraction of their actual value, and the new owners, most of whom are affiliated with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is the military, which is a de facto state in Iran, they took loans based on the actual value of their new companies, and they either offshored the money or they used it privately. Consequently, many factories have been on the verge of collapse, while the owners, having already profited handsomely, have no interest in maintaining them. And so in a bunch of workplaces and factories across Iran, it is workers who are concerned with maintaining the flow of production and keeping factories open and considering the bankruptcy of many of these large, recently privatized factories. Some of the unrest amongst workers has been channeled towards opposing privatization. Over the past 2 years, some workers have raised the demand to take back their factories from private owners and bring them under the control of workers' control, workers' councils. And this is where, partly where, the discussions around council management have resurfaced. Now, obviously, at this point, it's resurfacing. Well, actually, no, I'll come back to that. It's resurfacing within the context of the presence of an extremely vast repressive state apparatus that is being used to violently suppress workers. But there is a very inspiring convergence starting to take place between extremely radical protest movements like the ones that have happened recently in Khuzestan and all across the country, and mass strikes and workers' councils being the most memorable relic of the 79 revolution, starting to embody this convergence. I want to just give people a bit of a snapshot of the kind of militancy and energy of the Haftapa Sugarcane Workers' Union. So the sugarcane factory is in the city of Shush, and it's really now known as the Fortress of Labor Resistance in Iran. During a November 2018 march of thousands of workers, an episode in a three-month-long strike, Ismail Bakshi, the popular leader of the workers, advocated for the management of the factory under the supervision of independent workers' councils, and he said this: "The orders have always been from the top. Today we have decided to dictate rules from below. We assign tasks to the government. We act collectively and as a council. Individualists, nationalists, racists and reactionaries have no place amongst us. Our alternative are workers' councils. This means that we make collective decisions for our own destiny. We issue verdicts from below. We have experienced enough suppression." In response to that, thousands of workers shouted in support of these ideas and affirmed their collective power with clenched fists. And so the formation of the union emerged after a series of strikes, as I mentioned. This wasn't really just a labour uprising. It was an inflection point in the very mode of workers' struggle and organisation. And it started to unleash a hidden potential that has both pushed the labour movement into the broader political movement and inspired it to resurrect the council experience of 1979. Just as an update, on the 7th of September, the workers at Haftapa actually managed to overturn the privatisation of their company and officially remove the corrupt CEO that has been in charge of the factory for years. There's been an ongoing court battle. And so whilst it's still unclear exactly how the company is going to be managed, the workers are adamantly insisting that they will not accept any new privatisation. So, you know, in a statement, they've insisted that they want to be an essential part of any decision-making process from now on. They want to be directly involved in the process of hiring new managers, and they demand that their democratic union must be under workers' control with no involvement from the state. So we'll have to see what transpires. But I think that, you know, in combination with these this new sort of formation of a council, very broad at this point, but this year the council to represent the contract oil workers, broader discussions taking place about workers' councils is very inspiring. So in conclusion, I think there's a real possibility that there could be a revolution in Iran in the nearish future. I think if it's going to happen anywhere in the world, it can happen in Iran. I think in places like Khuzestan, and people might want to talk about that a bit more in the discussion, which is, like I said, the wealthiest region in Iran, on the border of Iraq, where there have also been protests and strikes of oil workers in Basra in recent years. You can see, and it's a deeply multi-ethnically diverse population. The protests that happened in 2019 started, actually, that spread across the country, started in Khuzestan. There's all sorts of movements for the rights of minorities in Khuzestan, as well as the enormous economic power that workers have in that region, in steel factories, in oil plants, gas, petro plants, and, you know, agriculture and manufacturing and so on. I think that there's definitely a potential for revolution in Iran. There's no guarantees. There are some pretty incredible obstacles, including the inter-imperialist tensions in the Middle East, competition between big regional powers, the repressive state apparatus, you know, things spilling out of control in Afghanistan. Iran will want, and they do want, stability in Afghanistan and for that situation to be contained. But there are reasons for hope. I think, you know, really any kind of intensification of this struggle, and that's what's going to happen. There's absolutely no sign that it's going away. People are facing down enormous repression of the regime so far. And I think what we're going to see is actually a continuation, a deepening and a broadening of this struggle. And that also has enormous implications for the whole region in the Middle East. If you think about, you know, broadening, deepening, strengthening of this workers' struggle in Iran, then it can have a flow-on effect right through the region in the way that the uprising of Egyptians and Egyptian workers did in Egypt back in 2011 to 2013. We know that there are some attempts being made to link up for Iranian left outside of the country, to link up with workers in Iran. There's also students on university campuses, leftists, Marxists of different sorts of groupings, making connections with workers in struggle. And so some really exciting things happening that we should keep our eyes on.